in Oxford, Lydia Del Rio in Zurich, and Dario Egloff, who was a student at ETH at the time, Andy Garner, who's a PhD, a DPhil student in Oxford, and Renato Renner, Elizabeth, who was a PhD student in Singapore at the time, and Vlatko, who's my present boss. So this is about relating the idea of work, like lifting things, with the idea of information. So why should you care about that? So for me, I always found that there was something conceptually very interesting about this, the fact that information is subjective in nature. I may flip a coin and hold it in my hand, and I see what it is, but you don't see it. So I would say the coin has no entropy, and you would say, oh, it has one bit of entropy. So information seems subjective, right? Or it is subjective, I would say. But energy, like the potential energy gain when I lift this bottle, is objective, you would say. So there seems to be some kind of tension. How can you have equations that relate energy and entropy in the same equation? Then there's a more kind of pragmatic reason, which is that actually understanding the fundamental limits to work and heat is extremely important for technology. And I like this quote from this MIT course on nanoelectronics that basically says that heating, so wasting energy in computers, for example, is a very key or the key technological challenge for miniaturizing electronics. And actually, in the same notes, they considered the arguments of Landauer and Bennett, which are very foundational arguments concerning the relationship between work and entropy, as a guide to guide them in what sort of technology might be possible in the future to get rid of these problems. So then you can ask, what can quantum information, which is kind of my background, help with here? I mean, shouldn't you leave this to the industrial companies, the semiconductor companies? And one of the things I think we can bring is that we understand entropy quite well. Then for people, for information theorists, they may hope to get something back from studying this. So for example, the von Neumann entropy, which is now the canonical or used to be at least a canonical information measure in quantum information theory. This actually was motivated by thermodynamical considerations. Okay, so there's a kind of approach to thermodynamics I'm going to talk about. You could call it smooth entropy thermodynamics or single shot, or there's many different names. There's a list. This is a list of papers that I regard as being part of this approach, and I'm going to focus on the ones where I'm an author. So, firstly, we'll start with this one, and then I will tell you briefly what these ones have, very briefly, and then go to here, and then. Assuming that I can stay disciplined with time, I will also tell you the key points of this paper as a sort of bonus. But the main point I want to make is really to get to the main result of this paper. So let's start with the sorry with part one. We're going to start with this one. So many of you have probably seen a Szilard engine. I'll go over this rather quickly. The idea is that, so this is a key prototypical thought experiment to relate entropy and work. So the idea is you have a particle, it can be in the left or the right. Now let's say that you know it's in the right, so you have one bit of information. Now there's a heat bath here at temperature T, and you're going to use the energy from this heat bath to extract work. How can you do that? You hook up a weight like this to this divider here, and then you let this guy kick on the divider. Keeps getting thermalized with the heat bath, so it's got energy all the time. Kicks on the divider until it's moved all the way over here, and the weight has come up. How much can you extract? Well, there's a rather naive calculation that you can make, which turns out to be okay, which is that you can put in the ideal gas equation and say that there's an initial volume of V, which is the volume of this, and a final volume of 2V, which is the full thing. And then you remember the definition of work in terms of the ideal gas stuff is PdV. And you just plug in the ideal gas equation and you get KT log 2. This is a naive calculation, but it turns out to be correct in a certain sense. Now, so what have you done? You've used up one bit, because in the end, the particle could be anywhere. And you've gained KT log 2 of work. More famous is actually the inverse process, which is when you reset this by letting the weight fall down. And then how much work does that cost you? Well, you just flip the integration around and you get a minus sign here. So you can say that it costs at least KT log 2 of work to erase. It should really be called reset because you're taking it to the right. And this is Landauer's principle. So, okay, a subtlety, if you start thinking about this engine seriously, at some point you will wonder about, can I really use thermodynamics on this kind of thing? And actually, if you just take naively model the system like this, then you have a problem, because what happens is that this is a very small thing, this weight, to balance the force from the particle. And it's a small moving part, and it's going to thermalize with the heat bath. Because this thing gets kicked by the particle, so through the particle it's going to thermalize with the heat bath, and it's going to move around a lot. So you shouldn't think of it quite like that. You should, for this result to hold, you should think of it as, these are the kind of graphs you get of distribution of positions of the divider. For different weights for different masses of the weight. So you see, it's really spread out, right? But what you should be thinking is instead that the divider speed is infinitely slow, and in particular, it moves independently of the particle. So there's some kind of external thing, or it's attached to something very heavy, and it moves along at a constant speed. And the thing you count as work is the extra help that you get from the particle in moving along. So this is subtlety, but it works if you think of it like this. And this is actually how people argue in other types of non-equilibrium statistical mechanics as well. We say Jasinski has this picture. Yes, this one.
Yep. So if I put, say, like a hole at the bottom in the middle and attached my weight to that, then it wouldn't matter whether the wall went to the left or the right, it would lift the weight. So the place where you really use your information is in kind of erasing, at the end of it there would be some sort of information about which path the particle started, because the rope would either be pulled to the left
exactly.
or the right. So the only benefit of your information is in erasing that. Not in knowing how to hook up the weight to the pulley, because I wouldn't need to know that to lift the weight. Is that
yeah, right? I guess I'm assuming that you're not allowed to randomize any other system when you're doing this. But what you're doing is that you're allowing for this. You're allowing to randomize the final position of the barrier instead, right? Because you're saying that you would. In one case, if the particle was here with your model, the divider would move here.
Yeah.
In the other case, it would move over here. Right? So it's like you've transferred your randomness into another degree of freedom at the end. So it's like Maxwell's demon memory in a way that you at the end it's been left randomized, and then indeed you have to reset it if you do it that way, and that's why this thing doesn't violate the second law. So when I say that it's for helping you to, it helps you to choose which side to hook up the divider from, it's because I'm assuming that at the end you have to know where it's going to end up. I don't know if I'm answering your question. If this is what you. I think we agree that the problem with that, why that one doesn't violate the second law, is because you randomize the position of the divider. You can't predict where the divider is going to be at the end, right?
But you still manage to lift the weight.
Yes, you do.
So the benefit of having the information of where the particle was is not in your capability of lifting the weight, because even not knowing where the particle was, I lift the weight, it's the ability to reset this back to its initial state.
But if you want to use the work for more operation, and if you get the wrong way, then you have to do an operation in order to use it. So if, I mean, if your overall goal is to get one of these weights up,
yeah,
then if you get the other one, then you'll have to do something in order to use that work to get your right way. So.
If your overall goal is to get the weight up, and you just put a hole in the bottom, and regardless of which way the piston moves, the weight will lift, because the rope is rigid and it has to, you know, extend, move, the piston moves over by length L, so the weight lifts by L. But if you, I guess, if you want to use this piston again, you need to reset it. Mm-hmm. That's where knowledge of where the particle was initially benefits you, because you're able to reset it to a fixed position.
I agree with what you're saying, but I'm not sure how to put it semantically, whether you can, I think you can also say that it helps you to choose the side, but then I'm assuming that you're not allowed to do a scheme where you randomize the position of the divider at the end, so where you don't know where it's going to end up at the end. So it's like you're not allowed to do a cheat in your entropy accounting by moving the entropy onto another thing. Yeah, it was a little bit of a semantical question of how I should phrase that. I agree with essentially what you're saying. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So you should have this picture of the divider moving infinitely slowly. Now, say you have many of these boxes, and then Bennett had a neat idea. Which is concerning, what if you have, say that you have some information about correlations. So this is the probability distribution over the particle position in the different boxes. Say that you know they're correlated, like this, but you don't actually know which side the individual particle is in. Then you can't use the scheme of just choosing where to hook up the divider, because you don't know where it's going to go. But Bennett points out, but you can now still extract KT log 2 of work from this bit, because you know one bit about this distribution, right? By doing a C0, and you know, classical mechanics and quantum mechanics allow you to do that in principle, and you get this new distribution afterwards. And now you know that the second particle is in the right. So now you could do the same scheme again. You have one known box, and you can now extract KT log 2 from the second box. And so you can generalize this kind of scheme to many bits. So imagine there's some initial distribution on these all these boxes. Then you apply something like a generalized C0, a permutation on the bit strings. And now you've compressed the randomness onto some of them. You can call this kind of information compression, that you're compressing your randomness onto some systems. Now you might guess that the optimal work that you can extract is KT log 2 times the number of known bits, these guys. Because you know, for each one of these that you know, you can get KT log 2, right? And this indeed turns out to be true, that you can show this is the optimal thing to do. But its S is not going to be the von Neumann entropy. So actually, the previous example I used with this distribution, it doesn't pose a challenge to the von Neumann entropy being the correct one. And this is because that distribution is an example which is flat on some events, but zero on the rest. Yes?
When you say a generalized C naught, what does that mean?
Right, so in the classical case, a permutation matrix. So a permutation of the bit strings. Does that make sense? So it's like it's going to move the different entries in the probability distribution around. Okay, now if you have these kind of distributions, a lot of entropy measures coincide. So in particular, the Reni entropies, which are given by this formula, so you get a different entropy for each alpha. They will all give you S equals log of D for such distributions, where D is the number of events with non-zero probability. Another thing to note about the Reni entropies is that if alpha is 1, you get the von Neumann or Shannon entropy back. But two others that are important here are S0 and S infinity. And they're called S max and S min because of this inequality. So in quantum information theory, Renner and others have shown that it's actually modified versions of S max and S min which capture the operational meanings that you want from information theory measures. And the von Neumann entropy is only relevant when it happens to coincide with them. So both in information theory, you could argue it's been found that you have to go away from the von Neumann entropy in general, and we're going to find the same thing happens with work. Let me just say a little bit more about these entropies. I know some of you know what they are, but I just want to say it to the others. So S max is the log of the number of events possible you can show. So that means the number of probabilities that are non-zero. S min is the log of 1 over P max. By that, I mean the peak probability. So basically, one tells you the width of the distribution, and the other one tells you the height of the distribution. One important operational meaning of S0 is that it is the size that a memory needs in order to reliably store information in a single message. So say that you're going to get a message from someone and it's going to be distributed according to this. So it could be 1 out of 8 possible messages. How large does your memory need to be? Well, it needs to have 1 state per message, right? So it needs to have 8 states, and if you ask in terms of bits, you have to take the log 2 of that. So the hmax tells you the number of bits that your memory needs to have. And it's called single shot because we're talking about a given experiment, not some sort of averaging. So the main results of this paper for part 1 is that If you want to be certain up to a probability of epsilon to extract work, the optimal you can do is n minus h max. Oh, I didn't define epsilon, sorry. I have to do that on the board. N minus h max epsilon times kt log 2. So I'll say in a moment what this thing does. Basically, if you forget about the epsilon for a moment, what happens is that the size of this is given by h max. And what's left here is n minus h max. But to say briefly what the epsilon does. So the idea here is that you say that you have that example from before with with 8 events, but say that you modify it a little bit, and actually you have like a really long tail here. But say that the total probability of being in this tail is something like 10 to the minus 10. then you might feel, oh, for practical purposes, I still only need 8 states in my memory. So I would basically chuck away this part and say, I'm going to pretend that part is not there. And then with probability 10 to the... with the probability of error, let's say, being less than equal to 10 to the minus 10, I only need a memory of this size. So for strange historical reasons, this new distribution here is called the smooth distribution. So I often write it as something like P epsilon, where this whole thing was initially P. So P is somehow this whole thing. I try to draw that in nicer. So what you get is you define the smooth entropy more generally as the you take the max entropy of some other distribution, possibly, which happens to be epsilon close to the original one. This is the kind of mathematical definition of this. But the intuition is that basically, for practical purposes, we can throw away some part of the distribution and pretend that we have a different one. Is that OK? So you can also get a kind of upper bound on the most risk-taking agents in terms of this one, but I think I'm not going to talk about that because I don't need it for the rest of the talk. Now, let me just say that you could now argue that entropy should not be defined as the Neumann entropy, because you could say that we should define entropy through work. And this is from Feynman Lectures on Computation, where he kind of reviews Bennett's work on these things. And you see how he says we could define the information in the tape by this formula. So here should go the max entropy, you could argue. Now, that's part one. Let's go to part two. So, okay, you probably have never seen this term before because I think we just made it up. At least I made it up, so maybe someone else has used it before, probably not. So let me just say, what is the von Neumann regime? By the von Neumann regime, we mean states which look like this. So you take rho to the tensor n, and n goes to infinity. And we call it the von Neumann regime because of this expression. So if you have, you take this entropy is called the smooth entropy, the one that has this epsilon in it. If you take the smooth entropy for any of these alpha entropies, and you plug in that state, then per bit you get the von Neumann entropy. And this is a key way in which you relate these two approaches to quantifying information, that you actually recover the von Neumann entropy in this limit. So in this part, we're going to generalize the question about the relationship between work and information. So there's going to be, again, a system like the gas, but more general. Yes?
I was wondering about the epsilon.
Yes?
I thought in Tomomi Hill's thesis, he had an asymptotic limit in which epsilon doesn't have to go to zero.
It doesn't have to.
So did you choose to keep the epsilon here for some reason, or choose to keep the epsilon approach to zero for some reason? Is it free?
No, actually, it doesn't have to go to zero, but people used to write it like this earlier on. Is there any reason why you should really take it to zero?
Because it has to use a different distance measure.
Yeah. No, I guess one reason why that's interesting here is that it shows that you can do, you can make it arbitrarily small. So that means that your error, for example, in your statements can become arbitrarily small in this limit, and that's important for us. So some things that might not be deterministic away from that limit can be made deterministic in this case. Okay, so the generalized question is that we're going to say that this thing is just going to change from some state rho to some state sigma. So before we had, you know, one bit that was known and then became randomized. So these were, that was a particular choice of initial and final state. But let's now consider a more general setting. How much work can you get? So now, one subtlety is what do we actually mean by how much work can we get? How do we mean by work? And one of the important points is that we're not interested in the energy gained on average over many realizations, but for a given realization. So you can imagine this guy, he's implementing a work extraction protocol where he's lifting this box up to the table. There's some potential work gain by doing that. Now, what do you care about? If he says, "Oh, hire me because I'm really good at lifting boxes," then do you care about whether he can, on average, lift it up to the table? Or do you care about whether he can actually lift it up to the table in every experiment? I mean, he might have some strategy where he like shoots the box up into the air. It's not entirely realistic, but say that he shoots the box up high in the air, and sometimes he can hit the table up here if he's good when his aim happens to be good. But all of the other times it crashes on the floor, right? Then that average could be higher than this table of his protocol. That's an extreme case, but it seems somehow natural to not be interested in the average in that sense, but actually what can you do in any given experiment. So we're going to define the work value of going from rho to sigma as the maximal threshold, the kind of largest table that you can exceed in any given extraction for a given rho and sigma. So, and then there's a complication, generalization that you may want to consider a probability epsilon of failing to achieve W. So, for example, he may, you know, very, very occasionally hurt himself when he's lifting things and fail. But that's okay, because you don't need to succeed with 100% probability all the time. So you might be interested in a more general quantity, which is how much work you can get except with error probability epsilon. And then we write that quantity like this. W epsilon rho goes to sigma. Okay, so there have been some radical generalizations now for how to calculate this. So there was the papers that I showed in that list. There's one by Johan Åberg and this one by Hordechki and Oppenheim. And they both go significantly beyond the paper in part one. In particular, they consider non-degenerate energy levels. So in part one, we actually implicitly assume that all the possible states in terms of left and right were the same energy. That's one of the reasons we could do unitaries or permutations for free, because it didn't involve changing the energy of the state. But they went beyond that. And they both find a work value for taking an initial state, which is arbitrary, but with a given set of energy levels, so for a given Hamiltonian, to a thermal state on the same set of energy levels. And what they find is actually a relative Renyi entropy is the expression. I can write it out if you want. So that what we do in this paper in part two is that we go further by calculating this quantity for an arbitrary initial and final energy spectra. So the idea is there's some initial state here by which I include the energy levels and the probabilities of occupation. And this goes to some arbitrary final state in terms of energy levels can change and the probabilities can change. You've noticed that the fact that I'm drawing it like this means that I'm talking about diagonal, about density matrices that are diagonal in the energy eigenbases. And this is an assumption that we've made at the moment. So we're effectively assuming that the coherence is much faster than thermalization. And we're working on getting rid of that assumption, and we think we can. But at the moment, this is an assumption from what I'm going to tell you. Okay, so this guy is going to go from rho to sigma. How much work can we get out at most? To get an intuition for how we calculate this, consider a simple example that we've sort of done induction on. So say you have two levels and you have a random bit on them. This is from this paper. Now you want to reset that. So this is a lambda as a ratio type scenario. How can you do that? Well, one protocol is that you keep thermalizing this with a heat bath and you quasi-statically raise this guy towards infinity. Then it will always be in a thermal state, so the probability of this thing will go towards zero. And then you decouple from the heat bath and you lower the level back down. Now you have a reset your bit. You can work out how much that costs. So, because you know the state is given by this Gibbs state, the thermal state. Now, an important thing for how you define the work now. So you say that if a level is occupied, if and only if a level is occupied, when you raise it by a small amount, it costs you that amount of work. And now you can work out the expected work, which actually turns out to be the work you get with probability one in this case, because you have infinitely many small steps. And you just plug in the probability. So this is for an infinitesimal step. It's going to be zero if you're in E1 because you're only moving E2, but it's going to be DE2 if you're in E2. So you just get this quantity, and now you can integrate that out over the whole lift as you lift this thing up, and it turns out you get KT log 2. So this is a simple example. It turns out to be an optimum protocol. You can also think about where epsilon enters, so you can say, actually, I don't really care about this being precisely one at the end. I could just put in enough work to lift it up to some finite height, and you get a smaller amount of work that's necessary. But you get this extra term here. And now, so what we can do is we can calculate this thing for arbitrary initial and final spectra. But to give you that expression, I have to give you two definitions first. So the first one is a measure of how much more random a distribution is than another. We just call it the relative mixedness. It's related to the notion of majorization. So what is majorization? If you have two distributions, say that you have this blue thing in the back and the green one in top. Now you can draw the integrals of these guys. And if and only if one, say the blue one upper bounds the green one, do you say that the blue distribution majorizes the green one? So first you always order them in descending order, the different distributions. You can see that like the uniform distribution is always going to be worse because it's always the slowest one to get up to one. But non-uniform distributions can get up to one quicker sometimes. The relative mixedness, this is the thing we're defining between two states, is the maximum stretching factor by which you can stretch this guy along like that, such that it's still upper bounds the other one. So in the simple case to the left, I must have moved that around, in this case, you have, let's say you have two uniform distributions. They just become straight lines when you integrate them, right? Now you can stretch this guy all the way over here, and the ratio is B over A. So in this case, M of P versus Q is B over A. In this case, it's just going to be 1. Actually, sometimes we include the log when we define it. I don't think we really settle on that. Let's say if it's just the ratio, then this is going to be 1. So this is a way of putting a number to how much one distribution majorizes another. Okay, now there's this thing called Gibbs rescaling. So this is something that you do to the probability distribution over energy eigenstates. And the general idea is that it removes the bias imposed by different energies. Because you know how the thermal state is non-uniform in general, so somehow it favors the lower energy states. And we're going to remove that bias to create the new distribution. And in particular, we're going to do it in such a way that a Gibbs thermal state is actually going to become uniform. So just as an example of this, and on the next slide, I'm going to try and give you a hint, explain to you why one might do this. But here's an example. So on this side, we have the original distribution, just with probabilities, independent of the energies. Here's the Gibbs rescaled one. You see how it's defined, is that you multiply these probabilities by these Gibbs factors, actually it's like dividing by the e to the minus e I beta factor. And you do a corresponding change to the width. So actually the area of these blocks are the same before and after. Now, if you change the probabilities, the Gibbs rescaled one changes along. And if you change the energies, this guy doesn't change, but this guy changes, right? So this is some kind of distribution that takes into account both the energy and the probabilities of your state. And it turns out that all the information we need is going to be encoded in this distribution. So how might you think of this? Well, one way of thinking about it is that, let's think about how do we model interactions with the heat path? You have some energy occupation values, and they go towards the Gibbs state with some new values. Now, there's some good reasons to think that this should be modeled as a stochastic matrix, meaning just a matrix with transition probabilities like this. And moreover, this matrix should leave the thermal state invariant, because when it's acting on the thermal state, it shouldn't do anything more. Now, one issue is that we would like to really be using a particular class of stochastic matrices, which are called doubly stochastic or bistochastic, because they are, one of their properties is that they leave the uniform distribution invariant. Actually, the reason we want to use them is that because there are results linking them to majorization. But the problem with doing that is that the thermostate is not in general uniform. But what you may do is to make it uniform by splitting events. So let's say that you have, this is your thermostate. Now you may pretend that actually this is two possible states. And bang, you have a uniform distribution. And this, you have to, if you do that, you have to do a corresponding change to your thermalizing matrix. And this is actually what the Gibbs rescaling does. And now it turns out you can show that this new matrix, when you do this, which makes sense, right, that you have a uniform distribution is stationary. This new one is doubly stochastic. It's a little bit like, I don't know, if some guy wanted to say, don't tax me as a rich person, I'm really not that rich, I'm actually made up of 1 million people. And then you spread out the money between these 1 million people, and instead of having a big peak, it becomes like a wide spectrum like of low values. Okay, so the main result of this paper now in terms of these two definitions. For arbitrary initial and final occupation probabilities and energy spectra, the optimal work for a probability of error epsilon is given by the relative mixedness of the Gibbs rescaled distributions. The expressions, which is the same by Oberg and Hordeschke and Oppenheim, are recovered in the case where the Hamiltonian is the same initially and finally, and the final state is a thermal state. The expression for part one is recovered for the case of fully degenerate energy levels. Everything's the same energy. But this was actually already showed by Oberg that's a special case of their expression. So that follows trivially in a way. And we also get this standard free energy expression, which some of you will have seen, in an appropriate limit. But in general, the expression can be very different to this one.
Oscar,
yeah?
10 minutes.
Okay, and that's not too bad. Another result to wrap this paper discussion up, before moving to the bonus part, is that the second law needs tightening. And this is actually something that has been shown in a way by these guys already in the 70s, but somehow it didn't kick off. I'm not sure why people didn't pick up on it. Maybe what we can contribute now is somehow related to our model and also make a slightly more dramatic claim. So the consider the system interacting with the heat bath. Now, the system state will have a von Neumann entropy. The heat bath has a temperature associated with it, and the system has an internal energy. Now, the change in this thing is normally said that this needs to be greater than or equal to zero for an interaction with the heat bath. Now, we find that in this kind of model of thermalization, this is a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient to guarantee that it's possible. So instead, we should say that a state change rho to rho prime is possible if and only if this thing holds, which is just another way of saying that the initial the Gibbs free scale distribution majorizes the second, the post-thermalization interaction Gibbs distribution. And I think this is also true for the model by Oppenheim and Horodetsky. Now, what makes this interesting is that there are actually processes that respect this equation but violate that one. And we find that if we now try and consider such a process as being real, then we get a strange result that you could extract deterministically, so we probably probability of error zero, work from a single heat bath in a cycle. So you would be violating Kelvin's version of the second law, which probably you don't want to do. So that seems to be an argument against treating this as necessary and sufficient. Yeah.
So what's your definition of work?
So if I go back.
Indicates where the energy levels also change.
Yes. I don't know what happened. So if I go So this is the key rule that you apply that to whenever you move a level, that if the level is occupied when you move it by some amount delta E2, it costs you delta E2. If you raise it, if you lower it, you gain delta E2. So this you can apply to any state. Whenever you move a level, if it's occupied, it costs you work. I mean, it is a tricky thing defining work in a general way. I feel like in this model it's quite concrete, and I believe there's a good definition. but it's hard to come up with a model independent definition of work somehow. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes. Which one?
Just the necessity but not sufficiency of
yes.
being increased. So one comment, I think because the Brook and Mead paper appeared in a chemistry journal, that might be part of the reason why nobody picked up on it. But there's this famous paper by Lieb and Ingvesson where they try to show that increase of entropy is necessary and sufficient. It is the
that sounds like
do you know this really long paper by Lieb and
I've heard of it but I haven't read it.
Okay, so I was just wondering what
so they claim is necessary and sufficient?
I think so. It basically showed that it fully characterizes the order in thermodynamics.
Do they do like
assumption
yeah?
They make.
Okay, I haven't read it, but it's very interesting to know that actually. I don't know. I can speculate. do they have IID assumptions? Because what happens is if you have like if you have IID states, the two notions coincide in the limit as n goes to infinity, because that effectively you have uniform distributions
right.
only. And for if you have two different uniform distributions, if one majorizes the other, the entropy is greater or in the right direction and vice versa. So if you have like
right.
uniform distributions, the two coincide. And maybe they do that.
Actually, now that you mention it, it's probably okay because they have an axiom, or it's not called an axiom, but a hypothesis that at some point that for every two states, either you can get from one to the other or back. And in the single shot regime, that would fail.
Yeah.
And so the result would hold. But in the asymptotic regime, that would be true,
yeah.
And then the result is correct.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, no, yeah, you definitely can't assume that you can get reversibility in that sense here. Actually, another important point which I should have made is that note that this thing is a function of two states. So there's some initial state and some final state. And you can't, in general, write it as a function just of a state. This is a difference too. So you normally free energy is written as a function of state, and you take the difference between two states to get the work that you can extract. But here you have to treat it as a two state thing. So okay, should I go to the bonus part? How are we doing?
5 more minutes, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. They're not asleep yet. okay, so the bonus part is this one. So this is about negative entropy and how to relate that to work. So what is negative entropy? So you've seen this definition of conditional entropy probably. So there we have AQ and we just take the difference like this. And I think in this section, I'm going to suppress the single shot entropy stuff and just do it with the phenomenon entropy to get the key point, conceptual point across. So a simple example of a state that has negative entropy is this one, negative conditional entropy we mean. In this case, if you plug this in, you will see that the entropy of the total state is zero because it's a pure state. The reduced state on Q is maximally mixed, so you get -1. Now we want to interpret this in a kind of lambda or Szilard sense. So what we do is we include the observer's memory, Q, explicitly in the description of the total system. So there's the scenario now is that we've added this thing. Before we just had, we've also added the reference, but I'm not going to refer much to that now. Before we just had the heat bath and the system and the battery, right? But now we're going to step out and include our knowledge in the picture by talking about it as correlations between the system and our memory. So what we give is a protocol that erases, meaning resets the state of A. And for any initial joint state on A and Q, the work cost of this protocol is this. So this also holds in the case of a negative sign here. So I think a simple example illustrates this quite well. So let's again take the state. Now, the first part of the protocol is that you extract work from both of these. Remember that, because otherwise you won't be able to reproduce the argument. You extract work from both Q and A together. And then you reset A to whatever state you want to be reset to. And this costs you kt log 2 of work. Whereas, of course, you can extract 2 kt log 2 of work from a pure 2-qubit system. And what is the net result? Well, we reset A to 0. A subtlety which is important is that we left the reduced state on Q unchanged. So this is, again, not to cheat with entropy accounting, that we're only allowed to use the correlations between the memory and the system. We're not allowed to change the state on Q beyond that. Otherwise, we could cheat and just add lots of pure qubits to Q and extract however much work we want. So what is the net work? You just take the difference. In this case, you see that it happens to be given by the conditional entropy, and it actually means that we've gained work by resetting the system. One funny application is for cooling quantum computers if or when they're built. And the idea is that you divide your bits into output bits and the rest. And now we want a procedure that doesn't change the statistics on the output bits, right? Because we don't want to mess up the calculation. And that's like the condition of keeping the memory of the Maxwell Demon state invariant. So this is going to be like the memory. Now, there's some big unitary that entangles these things, and actually in say Shor's algorithm, you don't need to measure all the output qubits. And what we're going to do is to just basically extract work from the correlations between these guys and here with that protocol. And the statistics are left invariant. But the energy extracted must come from the heat bath, which is actually the computer and its surroundings. So the computer must have been cooled. I'm not saying this is a realistic engineering thing at the moment, but it's a neat thing, possibly. So, okay, to finish, I can never remember who said that, but now when I was downstairs, I saw that Mike Lasseridis had said something very similar on the entrance to PI. Maybe that's where I got it from, I'm not sure. What are we going to do next? So there are several generalizations of the expression for this, which we are working on. We're also working on understanding the connections to related approaches like resource theory, which there are experts in the room on, typical entanglement, which there are also experts in the room on. There's a whole approach which I'm not sure what to call, but the papers usually have titles like "What are the smallest refrigerators?" With Paul Skripchik and Popescu and others, and the whole open quantum systems stuff with master equations and so on. I think it's really important that we engage with experimentalists. So we are doing that because somehow it feels like the original thermodynamics was created not out of the blue by theorists, but it was in connection with actual experiments that people wanted to understand. And to make sure that this approach is sound, we should probably make sure that we can ask the questions that they actually care about. So ultimately, what we want to do is to have a full approach to statistical mechanics, which takes into account the insights from modern information theory. So, thank you.
Other questions?
So in the part where you were determining the work to extract under the transition row to sigma, at that stage, you were not demanding that any correlations that rho might have with other systems are preserved in the transition, that I could, if the system for which rho is the state were correlated with something else, you're not demanding that you preserve those correlations. You
could no. Them. Yes. Okay. I guess you are doing that in many cases because you could purify it. You can imagine it's a purified state, and in the end you maybe reset it or something, and then you kill the correlations, or if you randomize it too. Yep.
So that the work that you can go from rho to sigma, extract from rho to sigma, that can be negative,
Yes, so you could do the same thing for lambda as erasure, and the same expression applies in that direction too.
Okay, but then the work to go from rho to sigma, is that equal to minus the work to go from sigma
to
rho?
Not in general.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's your version of it.
Yep.
And that particular negativity has nothing to do with quantum mechanics, presumably, just as...
Yeah, no, that's not a quantum... Yeah, that's a different one.
When the agent is trying to turn rho into sigma, according to the steps that the agent can take, the system's size doesn't change, does it? As in the dimension of rho is the same as the dimension of sigma, or the dimension of the space on which it's defined?
Yeah, the dimension of the space on which it's defined, I would say, is the same. But you could kill some probabilities, so you could have initially a bigger support, for example, than finally on the stage.
Other questions? Then, yeah, let's thank Oscar again.
Thank you very much.